It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And of course, if you do go out and about, things are beginning to look a lot like the holiday season. Poinsettias are everywhere. And we're going to talk about how this beautiful plant became a holiday symbol and also how to take care of them later on in the hour. Though, of course, you are welcome to join us with your plant questions about any of the plants and trees in your life. You can give us a call. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Aaron Style of Ryman Gardens in Ames will be here in a few minutes, but we're going to start the hour with Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Hello, Chris.
What's up, Cherry? How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for being here.
Tis the season, is it not?
It is. And the poinsettia is a plant with a rich history. So give us a little bit of background. Where are poinsettias native to?
Their native range, where we'd find them naturally, would be in southern Mexico. That would be their primary range where they're native to. But now we've got them on six of the seven continents, thanks to us people.
All right. And now, obviously, people who live in their native range had discovered the poinsettia long before it started being shipped all around the world. But what do we know about how the poinsettia got to be a plant that people cultivated to display in homes?
Well, the indigenous peoples of Mexico were already ahead of us on that one, too. The Nahua people in southern Mexico recognized the poinsettia for its ornamental value. The problem was, if you go to what was the capital, well, what we call now Mexico, what would be now Mexico City, the poinsettia wouldn't grow in that high altitude because it was so cold. But every winter, the rulers would still import thousands of these plants, these native poinsettias, up to the higher altitude areas for that winter season when they were forming their red bracts. So this seems to be a plant that was born to be enjoyed for the holiday season. As far as how it made it up to the United States, there's a couple of different stories. There's one that sounds really good, and then there's reality, and there's something probably in the middle. It's called the poinsettia, and that's named after a former ambassador to Mexico from the United States, Joel Robert Poinsett. And horticulture was actually a pretty popular hobby among lots of people, especially the more well-to-do people were interested in ornamental horticulture. And so when Joel Robert Poinsett was an ambassador in Mexico, the traditional story is that he saw this plant, and it was again being used at this Christmas time because the naturally shortening days of fall meant that these plants were turning red every time, at the same time every year. And so there's a story that he sent seeds back to the United States to a friend, and then his friend then grew these plants and displayed them in Philadelphia at the flower show. And I think, 1829 was the first year that it was actually displayed in the United States as a new cultivated ornamental plant. But the facts that support that are somewhat dubious. Clearly, it's still named after Joel Robert Poinsett, the ambassador to Mexico, but it's not total. The facts don't support that he necessarily got the plant to his friend in this that then brought them to the Philadelphia Flower Show. So there's actually a bit of a mystery. So it's not totally clear, and we're just left to look at the history and try and decide what we think happened. But we do know that in 1829, it showed up on the scene and started to become a houseplant. And it wasn't long after when it started to become very popular for a Christmas plant. People would grow them before they were started to be forced in nurseries. They would actually be grown out in the fields in California, and then they would be dug up and then shipped by train east, where then they could be cultivated and finished out.
Well, and they're very difficult to cultivate. So I understand why their beauty would captivate people, but Maybe I'm overstating that. Maybe they're not as difficult to cultivate as I think, but I know that if I want a poinsettia to bloom again the next year, it's going to take a whole lot of work.
Yeah, so there's the trick, Charity, is if we were to ignore the red bracts or those modified leaves that make that flower, if we were to ignore that, the poinsettia is not that difficult a plant to grow. It'll tell on you if you let it dry down really hard. You know, wait. I can always tell which of my students enjoyed a good weekend because about 5 or 6 days after the previous weekend, you'd start to see some lower leaves crinkling because they'd gotten too dry on Saturday or Sunday morning. But other than that, they're actually pretty simple to grow. The real trick is how you get the plant to form those red leaves. And that's all about what you're talking about, trying to get the flower. You have to control the day length. And so you're either shuffling it into a room right around sundown, or you're putting it in a room that doesn't have any reading lights that you might be turning on at night, because it needs those naturally short days in the fall. The same thing that triggered ducks to fly south, the same thing that triggers a bear to start its hibernation state, it's that shortening length of day that induces the poinsettia to flower.
All right, so in an artificial environment, that's pretty hard to do. Of course, in its native environment, the sun does that.
Yeah, it would. And really the trick is because we create what we would call light pollution. If you had no lights on in your house, a poinsettia would flower just fine in the winter. But you flick on a light in the evening to make dinner, to watch television, to read a book, do the crosswords, whatever. And that ends up extending the day. So the poinsettia is thinking it's still late August.
Now, when we buy them in stores, we can see a variety of different colors and variegations and things like that. Are all of those naturally occurring, or are these things that we've been able to breed into the plant?
So what you'll always have, these things are all naturally occurring to some degree, because that's how we get these traits. You know, at some point there was a poinsettia that had some albinism and didn't have red bracts, and it had white bracts. And from that white bracted poinsettia, we started to select and breed for the white poinsettias. And so what we've done, or not we've, what poinsettia breeders have done is they've found these traits in poinsettias, and then they exploit them purposefully by breeding for a brighter red or a whiter white or maybe some of the jingles. So you wouldn't necessarily go down to southern Mexico into the rainforests and find the orange bracted poinsettia, holiday spice, or the jingle bracted poinsettia, jester. You would see that red one. But there might be one in those populations that might have a slightly more orange bract or maybe a few spots on that bract. And that's what we would use then, and you know, focus breeding, much like we do our F1 hybrid corn and soybeans, same kind of deal, controlled
all right,
crosses.
And I think you've told me before that there's actually a way to introduce a virus into poinsettias to create different colors?
Yeah, I think it's a phytoplasma. Oh, my friend Lena sent me an email after the last one because I misspoke on this, and I'm expecting a similar email today. So Lena Rodriguez, I am sorry, but it's a graft transmissible phytoplasma that ends up promoting branching, because what you have to do is, previously when you grow poinsettias, you'd have to plant multiple cuttings to get a nice full plant, but that costs a lot of money because we're using rooted cuttings and not seeds. So what we've done now is we plant a single cutting, and then we pinch it, and then we get multiple branches on it to make a nice full cutting. Early on, poinsettias didn't branch that well, except there was one that did branch well, and I think the name of that cultivar was Annette Hegg, named after the breeder's wife. And that cultivar branched very well, and so what they did is, when they got a new poinsettia cultivar that had those nice colors of bract that you were looking for, but it maybe didn't branch well, they would take that old Annette Hegg, and they would graft it with this new variety, and then that phytoplasma would transmit into the new variety and give it that now free branching agent. It's pretty cool. It's pretty interesting.
If I buy one of these plants, and of course many, many people do every year to bring into their homes, to bring into their offices, probably a little less of that this year, but they're so beautiful during the holiday season. How do I take care of them?
Well, I'm giving the same primer. My 4-year-old twins got their first. They each got their first poinsettia this year, so we're kind of going through the ropes now. They did well with their garden this summer, so now we're going on to houseplants. You want to put it in some nice indirect light. You don't want to have it getting fried in that south window. Poinsettias clearly like warm temperatures, but if you're sitting in front of a magnifying glass, it gets warmer than you'd like pretty quickly. You do want to keep poinsettias not well watered, sopping, anything like that, but they don't like to dry down. So maybe if you're growing a holiday cactus, you know, that's another one of those plants that flowers in the fall in response to short days. You want to be watering your poinsettia more often than you would your Thanksgiving or Christmas cactus, because it likes a little bit more moisture than those succulents or something like a jade plant. You'd water it real similarly to any other foliage type plant that you would have in your house.
Okay.
And you don't really need to be concerned about fertilizing it, because it can be such a big challenge to try and create those short days. You know, I really encourage people to purchase poinsettias, enjoy them, throw them away, and then get back out there the next year and support our local Iowa greenhouse growers.
All right. And are there a lot, I know that you produce poinsettias on campus, but are there a lot of people in Iowa actually growing poinsettias?
Absolutely. Iowa is actually home to several. Iowa has our greenhouse industry is generally about 24th or 25th in the country. So we're right in the middle. We're usually dancing back and forth with Indiana. So it's not only corn, soy, and pigs we're fighting with Indiana about, but now greenhouse crops. But we're about 24th or 25th in the country. And in fact, we've got two of the top 100 greenhouses in North America in our state. We've got one greenhouse that's topping over 80 acres and one that's over 20 acres, and they are definitely growing poinsettias right now.
Wow.
We're also home to another unique business, and while this business does finish poinsettias, meaning growing them out to flowering, they also specialize in rooting the cuttings. And so we've got a greenhouse up in northeastern Iowa that is responsible for a large share of the poinsettias on the market as far as propagating those cuttings and getting roots on them in July and then sending them all across the country for growers to finish.
Wow. All right. An Iowa industry I didn't know very much about.
Absolutely.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Chris Curry is with me, assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. We've been talking about poinsettias, but of course you are welcome to join the conversation with any questions about plants or trees in your life. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Aaron Style of Ryman Gardens in Ames is going to join us in just a few minutes as well. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Aaron Style is now here, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here, Aaron. And of course, the holiday season is a pretty busy time at Ryman Gardens. I saw that you guys have come up with a creative way to welcome people to the gardens during the holidays. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yes, we have a new outdoor walk-through holiday light show called Winter Wonderscape. And so all 17 acres are featured with holiday lights and all sorts of fun kind of light show types of things that you can walk through and see light tunnels and all sorts of fun things.
Well, that sounds really beautiful, and thank you for coming up with a way for people to safely enjoy the beauty of Ryman Gardens in the midst of a pandemic. I'm sure that's been an incredible challenge over the last year.
Yeah, it's been a challenge, but it's been a good one to work through, and the staff have worked really hard. And last night was our first night of the exhibit, and we have Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights through December to show off these lights.
Nice. All right, let's get to some questions. You are welcome to call with your questions about any of the plants or trees in your life, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Carol is up first in Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your question?
Okay. So I've been seeing online suggestions to soak my tulip and daffodil and crocus bulbs in warm water for anywhere from 3 to 12 hours before I plant them. What's your view on that?
Aaron, you want to take that one?
Well, you know, some bulbs, especially kind of the ones in the cheap bargain bins at some of the discount stores, may be a little on the dry side, and so that may help them. Overall, I probably wouldn't do it. I would. Most bulbs are pretty good at getting their thing done without a lot of help, and so just putting them in the ground and making sure that you water them in well after planting is probably the best approach.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for your call, Carol. 866-780-9100 is the number. From Judy in Cedar Rapids, I have an unruly forsythia hedge I was planning to pull out, but the blooms survived the heavy frost last spring. It looks like I have a hardy variety worth saving. Can I cut it back now, or would it be better to wait until spring? And honestly, I'll tell you, Chris, I'm not sure about all of your specialties, so I'm going to toss that question to you, but you guys can tell me who should answer the questions.
I think I'm going to try and make Aaron proud. And as a greenhouse controlled environment person, I'm going to attempt to answer a landscape question.
All right.
You game with this, Aaron? And then you can grade me afterwards. So with forsythia, right. They bloom so early in the spring, they already have their flower buds on them, much like a lilac. And so whether you're going to prune it now or later depends on if you want to see the flowers. If you are more frustrated with the unruliness of the forsythia, feel free to go out and hack at it this winter. Just don't expect to see as many flowers because you're cutting off the buds. Alternatively, if you can stomach it, let the unruliness continue, enjoy that beautiful yellow show, and then after they flower, go in and hack away.
All right. How did he do?
Yeah, A.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
That's exactly right. What I would suggest too.
Here's a question from Kathy for you, Aaron. Do I cut sweet autumn clematis back to the ground in winter? Should I cut it back to the bottom of the trellis, 16 inches above the ground, so new growth will climb the old stems so I don't have to train them up onto it?
Yeah, sweet autumn clematis is one of the varieties or species that you can trim back to the ground each year. And in some ways, this can be really nice because it can get a little seedy. Anybody who has one of these plants probably notices it popping up in a lot of different places. So trimming it back and moving some of those seed pods and some of those things may help with that a little bit too. But not all clematis can be trimmed this way, but sweet autumn can be.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Jack's got a question for you, Chris. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I have a beautiful poinsettia that I've nurtured since last Christmas. It is full of beautiful green leaves, and I'm wondering if, when, or perhaps how those leaves can turn from green to red.
Yeah, so you can do it, and it will take either an automatic timer, some dedication, or a big house with rooms that you can forget about. So the whole goal is poinsettias will normally initiate flowers naturally, sometimes between September 21st and September 27th in North America, depending on your location. So right about then is when the natural days start to turn short in the poinsettia's eyes. Or in its leaves. I guess potatoes only have eyes. Then what you want to do is, once the days turn short, you are either going to have to do one of three things. It's got to be in a room that's still heated like the rest of your house, but one that is not going to have lights turn on before sunrise that would make the day longer, or a room that would not have lights on after sunset that would make the day longer. So an empty, undisturbed room. Or you'd need to take that poinsettia and move it into that empty, undisturbed room every day to make sure that it gets a short enough day. Or if there are some sort of timers and lights, in the room, you just have to make sure that they're not on for more than 12 hours a day, because poinsettias need at least 12 hours of uninterrupted darkness. So if you decide to put it in a closet for 12 hours, an empty room, whatever, they just need 12 hours of uninterrupted darkness. If you get 6 hours of darkness and then you go down to the kitchen and flip the lights on to get a snack and the poinsettia is in there, that's going to interrupt the darkness. It's going to start all over again. And it's going to take usually around 8 weeks from the start of these short days, these 12 hours of uninterrupted darkness, about 8 weeks of that, and then you should have flowers on your poinsettia.
Thank you.
All right, good luck.
No problem.
Yeah, good luck. It's a real project, though, to take that on. I mean, I've likened it almost to having a pet. Do you think that's fair, Chris?
I think it is fair. And, you know, back in the day when I was in graduate school, walking uphill both ways, we had to go in and pull black cloth to cover the poinsettias to make sure that they didn't get dark. So I remember 8 o'clock in the morning and 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, like clockwork, I was in the greenhouse pulling shade cloth. So, yeah, it's quite a lot of work. So, again, I would encourage you to support your local Iowa greenhouse.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your question. Marty is up next in Johnston. Hi, Marty.
Hi. Yeah, you got my question about when and how to prune a smoke tree. Mine, I have two smoke bushes or smoke trees, and they get these very long, skinny branches during the growing season, and I don't like the look of it. I usually trim it back and have not been having the pretty little smoke flower, but I like the color of the leaves in the fall, so I'm willing to sacrifice the flower. So I wonder how to go about this and when.
Aaron?
Well, there are two different ways you can manage a smoke tree, and one is to basically trim it back close to the ground each winter. And you do sacrifice the flowers when you do that, but you tend to have nicer color foliage and a slightly better form when you do it that way. If the flowers are desired, you can't do that because the flowers are formed on old growth. Smoke tree tolerates cutting, you know, like a hard cut back fairly well. And so you can, I would probably go out in March and remove most of the growth. You can be really aggressive if you want, down to 6-8 inches from the ground and have it all come back from the base, or you can just remove some of the really unruly ones at that time. Either approach is okay.
Is there any way to get it to branch more rather than sending up these very long, skinny leaders?
Yeah, it can be a little difficult because, of course, its growth response is to do that after you cut it off. So you can do kind of a heading back cut and try to promote some branching a little bit lower on the plant, but not all the way down at the crown. And sometimes that will help, but smoke tree is kind of known for this kind of, I don't know, Dr. Seuss kind of look sometimes. So it can be a little difficult. That's where the art of pruning comes in and kind of playing around with it.
Okay, I'll just embrace the Dr. Seuss aspect. So. Thank you.
All right, Marty, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Richard's on the line with Des Moines with some firsthand knowledge of poinsettias. Richard?
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good, how are you?
I'm fantastic.
What would you like to talk about?
I used to live in California from 1980 to 2008, and in Manhattan Beach, California, there along the coast, below the airport, LAX, I had neighbors who could grow outdoor poinsettia trees up to like 6 feet in the ground. It was amazing. I wish I had taken a photograph of it, but it is adaptable, and they would like shroud it to darken it so that the red leaves would come back. It was amazing.
Yeah, and that's a lot closer what they would look like in their native environment. You know, they're going to be 5-6 feet up to 20-some feet. And I think we're so used to seeing them stuffed in a little 6.5-inch pot with a foil sleeve that when you see them in the landscape, it's a double or triple take, because surely that cannot be a poinsettia.
Yes, they are absolutely stunning and amazing. I never knew that they did that. I just wanted to share that with you guys. I moved back here in 2008. And I do miss a lot of things that I used to be able to grow out there. But that's okay. The agriculture here in my garden here is a totally different concept with lilies and hostas and everything else different, and it's wonderful.
Welcome back to the temperate Midwest.
All right, Richard, thank you so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Lois from Boone wrote to say basically the same thing that we just heard from Richard. She said, I was just telling my granddaughters this story. I visited Caracas, Venezuela for Christmas in 1986 and was delighted and stunned to find that poinsettias are trees. It was beautiful, magical to this Iowa farm girl and utterly enchanting. She says, I have a curious cat, so I'm thinking about buying a bunch of silk poinsettias to spruce up my house. All right, let's go back to the phones and let's talk to Jean in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am looking to put some fruit trees in my yard next spring because I had to get rid of my ashes due to the derecho. And I just wondered what would do well, what would be recommended?
Aaron?
In terms of fruit trees, apples are always a great option. When you do plant apples, you do need at least two different varieties to get good fruit set, and look for trees that naturally have resistance to really common disease issues that apples face, things like black spot and powdery mildew. If you're looking to only plant one fruit tree, a sour cherry can be really nice. They're self fruitful, so they don't need a partner for good pollination, and if you can get to the cherries before the birds, it's a really wonderful addition for pies and jams and all of those things, too. So that's where I would start with a fruit tree, here in Iowa, at least.
Okay, sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Jean. 866-780-9100. Next up, we've got Jerry in Ames. Another comment about poinsettias. Hi, Jerry. What do you want to tell us?
Hello, I want to make it easy for you so you don't have to put that in the closet, that poinsettia.
Okay.
At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, leave it right where you're growing it. Depending on its size, you can either put a big brown garbage bag over it, or if it's too big, you put a black garbage bag on it and leave it on until 8 in the morning. I graduated from Iowa State in horticulture in 1962, so it's been a while. But in 1955, I worked during the Christmas period at Lady of the Lake Seminary in Mundelein, Illinois, and we had poinsettias there. They'd make Christmas trees out of them in the different chapels from 6 inches to 16 foot. And after Christmas was over, when they were ready to get rid of them, they would let them dry down till the leaves turned yellow and fell off, and they would put them under the benches in the greenhouse and then bring them out in late summer to get new leaves on them. They'd give them a rest period, and they were beautiful. They would make these big trees out of them. We didn't have a big van to carry stuff around, so they looked like coffins out of wood that would take a 16-footer in there, would lay it down in there, and put a couple of buckets of hot bricks in them and haul them off to the chapels.
Wow.
And they did very well. But we lived in Minnesota for a while later on in the 70s, and I had a greenhouse there while I was teaching at the tech school. And we grew poinsettias for one of the churches. Some of them were 8 years old, and we could get them up to about 8 foot tall. And in the after the season was over, do the same thing, let them dry down, and then put them in a greenhouse that didn't have much light, so they didn't make a lot of growth until later in the summer. But it takes that long night, the same as a chrysanthemum does, in order to initiate its blooms.
Well,
but
Jerry,
it's very
yeah.
easy.
Sounds like you've had a whole lot of experience and you've seen some pretty fabulous results. So, Chris, you can stick a cardboard box over your plant
every day or a garbage bag. Jerry is spot on. Here I am, a professor, just making life harder for everybody. Yeah, that's a great idea, Jerry. It's the same concept. It's just still keeping it dark. And, you know, putting that black garbage bag over a poinsettia isn't going to look much different than my bags of hunting clothes by the back door. So it could pull that one off. Thanks, Jerry.
Well, you could decorate that cardboard box with a nice holiday theme or something like that, right?
No, that is a great trick.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much for your call. And we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes to talk plants on Hort Day here on Talk of Iowa with me, Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. You can join the conversation with your questions about any of the plants or trees in your life. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. They are here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And next up, let's go to Don on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Don.
Hi, this is Don.
Hi.
I'm here in Des Moines. Hi, I've failed in the past to be able to grow milkweeds plants to attract monarch butterflies in my yard. And in the past, I was advised to take pods that had seeds in them and distribute this, say, on top of snow. And they should come up in the spring. And this has always failed. What is your recommendation?
Aaron?
You can sow, I probably wouldn't sow them on top of snow, but you can sow them kind of lightly in the ground this time of year, as soon as the seed is viable, which should be around this time. One of the reasons why we suggest that, rather than trying to hold on to it and grow it indoors for transplant, is that sometimes this stuff has some rather complicated kind of stratification or cold requirements before it will germinate. And naturally, Mother Nature does this for us. And so we might as well just let her do the work. And we all know, anybody who's started to grow milkweed knows that it does germinate pretty well in some cases. But sowing it on top of snow probably isn't going to work as well as if you can get it kind of into the ground, maybe even watered in a little bit while it can get good contact with the soil.
Okay, we'll give that another try. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Don. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Dick is on the line next in Windsor Heights. Hi, Dick.
Good morning, Charity. I'm a victim of the derecho, and I need some help replacing two small crabapple trees, prairie fire crabapple trees.
All right.
I'm looking for some suggestions. I have the crabapple trees were on the northwest corner of our property, kind of right together, and they were just beautiful trees, but got wiped out. And part of the reason they got wiped out was that east of the trees was a big oak tree, and there was a young maple tree on the south of the tree of the two prairie fire trees that was getting bigger and bigger, and it turned out that the two crabapple trees were in the shade.
And so the derecho, they seem to have some kind of problems
because they were in the shade, and the derecho wiped them out. So I'm looking for suggestions for two nice or one nice colorful plant or tree or shrub to put in the place of these two trees. And, you know, there's not a lot of sunlight that they get except when the sun finally gets off to the west. So that's my situation.
All right. Aaron, you want to go first? And then, Chris, if you have any other comments.
So crabapple, especially the variety Prairie Fire, is actually a pretty decent selection for a small tree, but it isn't going to bloom as well or set fruit as well in more shade. Trees like redbud, and this would be particularly true for central and south southern parts of the state, can do really well in this situation, partially shaded or protected. That's a good spot for redbud. And so that would be my first recommendation. I would also look into some trees.
Is that a big tree?
No, that is going to be about the same size as a crabapple.
Oh, great.
20 feet tall. Blooms early spring before the leaves come out. It's usually around mid-April with pink flowers. And there are some white varieties with white flowers, too. And then has decent fall color, kind of a yellowish fall color. Another tree I'll look into that will be a little bit harder to find, but could be a lot of fun and definitely be something different, would do well in this situation, is yellowwood. It gets a little bit bigger, but not much bigger than the redbud, and has these long kind of panicles or clusters of white flowers that appear late spring, early summer. That can be really nice. Uh-huh. That one's a little harder to find in the nurseries, but likes that same kind of understory situation.
What kind of tree is the redbud? Redbud what? Is that a redbud oak?
Well, it is Cercus canadensis is the name. It's in the same family as honey locust and black locust and some of those kinds of trees. It's kind of its own kind of tree.
Yeah, okay.
Boy, those sound like two nice things. There seemed to be enough room for the
crabapple
trees, the two of them on the corner of our lot, but maybe one, you know, I can replace it with one or two of these.
Yeah, if you had room for two crabapples, there'll be plenty of room for two redbuds.
All right, Chris, did you have anything you wanted to add? Although it sounds like Dick's pretty sold on the redbuds, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah, I can't beat gardening with style.
All right. Dick, thank you so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Let's do a few email questions here. Darren in Rock Island says, first, thanks for recommendations 3 years ago to ensure that my Christmas cacti bloomed. It worked, and big blooms have emerged. I now have an indoor tropical plant conundrum. My one-year-old areca, I'm not sure if I'm saying that correct, palm sprouts new palms, but they appear dry and have some browning. After each palm spreads, they are brown. I've used only 10-10-10 fish fertilizer very sparingly once monthly and have a three-phase plant light above it for 3 hours each day in a minimal direct, under 30 minutes a day for 2 to 3 hours each day spot. It started well and continues to appear sad. Any guidance is appreciated.
Chris? I can take a little stab at that. Areca palms are a little bit challenging for the long term because they're very high light plants. And so the two things that I'm wondering about is I don't think it's the fertilizer. I'm not as concerned about that. I'm more concerned about if it's getting enough light. And the other thing is potentially if when the new fronds are unfolding, if it might be low humidity. And, you know, there are a number of lights above there. So I would maybe keep feeding that fish emulsion because that's got a low salt level, so you won't burn it like you might with a traditional fertilizer. But I'd think about maybe setting it on top of like
one of the recommendations we've talked about, I think, in the past on your show, for orchids to raise the humidity is to set them on a humidity tray. That's where you take some sort of solid bottom tray and you fill it with something like pea gravel or rocks or whatever you want to fill it with, and then you put water in that, and then you set the plant on top of those rocks, but not sitting in the water, so they're not, their feet aren't wet, proverbially speaking. That'll keep the humidity up around those fronds, which could help too. So I'm thinking it's more of a light and humidity thing. I don't think that it's going to be fertilizer. Aaron?
Yeah, I would agree.
All right. Good luck. I hope that helps. This one could be a stumper, Chris. This is from Mike. He says, I live part-time in Mexico and grow poinsettias outside in my garden. I have a recurring problem with my plants. The plants start out beautifully, but in June or July, the leaves develop a chalky white film on them. And
powdery mildew.
It's powdery mildew. Okay, can you
powdery
do,
mildew.
Can you
get
do anything
some baking
about it?
Soda? Mix up some baking soda, and then since it's not a real strong pesticide, you're going to have to do it frequently. But I think getting you to go outside in Mexico may not be the biggest challenge. But you can go ahead and spray the foliage down with that baking soda. That's probably one of the best home remedies that we use. Some other really simple things that you may be able to use with some effectiveness. Neem oil might be one, but I get concerned about you being outside and with that direct sun. That can cause problems when you apply neem oil. So I might suggest just start with a baking soda mixture.
All right. Well, I didn't know if outdoor problems in Mexico were going to be within your realm of expertise, Chris. So
I'm pretty sure that's what the problem is.
All right. Let's go back to the phones now. Lori's on the line in Davenport. Hi, Lori.
Hi. My sensitive plant, it grew exponentially this summer. I had it outside on my patio. It got these gorgeous little pink puff blooms on it. But now it seems to be, it's still growing, but it's just got these long spindly little legs or little arms. And I don't know if I should trim it back or what I should do with them. It's actually starting to grow some new leaves on the bald stems, but I didn't know if I should trim it back or just leave it be.
Aaron, are you thinking that might be light?
Yeah, it sounds like a light thing. Whenever you bring in something from outdoors, indoors, a sensitive plant likes a little bit more light than a typical house plant would. It's going to kind of pout a little. It may drop a lot of leaves. Things like hibiscus do this a lot. And sensitive plant, when it had that drastic change from the really bright light outside, even if it was in some shade outside, the light outside is much brighter than what most of us can provide, even inside a sunny window indoors. And so that big change in light is going to cause it to kind of, for lack of a better term, pout a little bit. It's going to kind of rear back a little bit. And now it's starting to adjust and it's starting to produce some new foliage as a result. But that foliage is probably going to be lankier and more spindly because there's less light indoors. You can provide supplemental light if you'd like, or you can just get it through the winter. It might look a little on the unruly side through the winter. Trim it back when you take it outside in the spring after the threat of frost has passed. And enjoy it outside the rest of the season.
Oh, so I should trim it back in the spring?
I would, just to help improve it. I mean, where sensitive plant grows naturally outdoors, it's weedy. In fact, when you run across folks who see this in a greenhouse, they sometimes chuckle because it would be like the equivalent of us going to a greenhouse and seeing a dandelion in a pot. So it is something that is a pretty easy to grow thing outdoors, and a pretty tolerant plant. But I wouldn't trim it back real aggressively under low light and stressful conditions of being inside over the winter. I'd wait until you move it outside and it can really start to flourish with the warmer temperatures and brighter lights.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Lori. And next, let's go to Bill in Solon. Hi, Bill.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, what's your question?
Okay. So I was wondering, is honeysuckle an invasive species in Iowa? And a second question was trying to get rid of, like, multiflora rose and things like that. is it good to cut those back this time of year, or should I wait till the spring when the sap's running and they're actively growing and then treat them with a Roundup or something? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Aaron, you want to tackle that?
Yeah, there are certainly a couple of exotic species of honeysuckle that are and can be quite invasive. Bush honeysuckle and Tatarian honeysuckle are the two biggest ones. They're native to Asia and Europe. And they are problematic because they can basically choke out a lot of understory things. They tolerate understory conditions better than some of our native plants, and then they kind of shade or choke out some of those things. And so you can control them kind of late summer into the fall by making sure that you remove seed pods if you see them, cutting them back. You can dig them, pull them up if they're small enough. And you can use herbicides. A lot of times kind of a cut and stump treat with a non-selective herbicide like glyphosate can be helpful. And doing that in the fall is fine. And I think the same can be said for the multiflora rose. Both of these plants are pretty tough. And so it will likely take persistence and multiple cutting and treating, or cutting and digging, to fully eradicate the plants.
All right. So this is a long-term project. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Let's try to get through a couple more questions here from Sally in Jessup. Speaking of invasives, there's a lot of garlic mustard still green under trees in part of my acreage. I've attacked it in several ways, digging it up in some places, spraying in others. My question is, if I mow off the second year plants before they produce seeds, is that an effective way to deal with them? And this may be outside either of your areas of expertise, but she also wants to know if goats eat these plants. So, again, Aaron, you want to take a stab at that? Can she mow off her garlic mustard?
Yeah, I mean, as long as it's not, hasn't gone to seed, and then you would be subsequently spreading that seed everywhere, it's certainly an approach you can take. I wouldn't be like, I don't think that's a silver bullet for its control, but one of the best ways to attack garlic mustard is to make sure it does not go to seed. And so anything you do to help either push that back or eliminate flowers and seeds is going to be helpful. I think so doing that could be beneficial, but it's not going to be a silver bullet.
All right. And goats, we may need a different expert on that one.
Yeah. You know, goats eat a lot of things.
It's true.
They may eat it. I have a feeling it would be one of those things that they may eat other things before they eat garlic mustard. But, you know, sometimes they surprise you.
All right. From John in Delmore, he says, and Chris, you can take this one. I have a small greenhouse, and I'm wondering why some bags of garden soil state for in-ground use. Is this safe for growing trays of lettuce in my greenhouse?
Generally, you don't want to. The in-ground use is going to have more of a mineral soil component to it, like a field soil component, whereas something for containers is going to be a soil-less type mix, even though we commonly call it soil. It's a soil-less mix, and it'll be based on like bark, peat, and coconut coir.
All right, and final question of the day, Aaron, is sheep manure safe for my garden? That's from Leonard.
Compost it first.
All right. As long as you compost it, it's like a lot of other kinds of manure. All right. Aaron Style, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
And Chris Curry, thank you.
Oh, yeah. No problem. You have a good one.
Chris Curry, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Aaron Style, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Horticulture Day will be with you through the winter months every other Friday for the most part. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.